This is a segment from The Annex, an academic sociology-themed podcast. For more, visit us on the web at theannexpodcast.com. And now we turn to Philip Cohen from the University of Maryland College Park. Philip wears many hats. He has a great blog, Family Inequality. He edits Context. He's chair of the ASA section on the sociology of the family. And he's spearheading a new and very exciting open research platform, Social Archive. We have a lot to talk about. Just very briefly, before we get started, I don't want these topics to get lost in the shuffle. Can you tell us, is there any news with the section on the sociology of the family?
No, sociology of the family just putters along. We have, 700-800 members. We produce sessions every year at the ASA conference. We give our awards. It's pretty much a normal business.
And Context, how's Context going?
Context, the exciting news is I'm done. Syed Ali and I are finishing our three-year term. The last issue is coming out. The fall issue is in production now. So when we when that goes out in the week or two, Rashawn Ray and Fabio Rojas will take over Context, and they have a lot of great plans, and it's going to be very exciting, and I will be done with it.
Always the best thing you can say about a service role.
Context is a great job. You know, if the future editors of Context are listening to this, I urge you to check it out because it is one of the fun ones.
All right. Well, I wanted to get the ball rolling with the Social Archive. Can you start maybe tell us what Social Archive is, how it works?
Sure. Social Archive is a paper archive or paper server, and it takes its inspiration from archive, from math and physics, which is ARXIV. Orchi. I don't know, maybe Gabriel knows about the Greek, or you all probably know about the Greek. But they started math and physics, which have really long lead times in publication. They started about 25 years ago or so sharing papers in preprint form before they were peer reviewed and published, just to get things moving faster, and also to have papers be free. And then just in the last couple of years, this has really taken off and spread across disciplines. So we started 1 year ago with Social Archive, and we cover all social sciences. It was created by sociologists and librarians, but it's for papers in any discipline in social sciences, arts, humanities, education, and law. Those are our categories. And the way it works is, it's a free server. You create an account, you log in, you upload your paper in just as a paper in your own formatting. And it goes through a simple moderation just to check that it is a paper, that it seems to be written by you, that it's in a language we can that our moderators can read, and then it's shared publicly. It gets a little bibliographic record. It gets a DOI, and then you can do whatever you're going to do with it after that. Send it off to peer review or present it at conferences or whatever.
Yeah, and I can attest to it from the user side. So my paper that I published in Phillips Journal, or what is now Phillips' former journal, I put the code and the data and the actual paper itself as well as kind of the extended club mix version of the paper up on Social Archive. And then for my paper that's under review now at a journal, there's a really cool feature where you can have kind of an anonymous posting of the data so that you can have your peer reviewers have access to your data, but without breaching double blind.
Yeah, that's a key. A key thing is that the Social Archive lives on the platform of the Open Science Framework, it's called. And what Gabriel's talking about there is you can have associated files with it, data, code, other drafts, versions, and so on. And those are sort of forever associated with the paper. But they also do have that feature where you can generate a link, a sharing link, which will share it anonymously. That's one of the cool features.
Traditionally, we've only been circulating written reports of people's final findings. And the idea that we can deconstruct research and use each other's scripts or share data easily and see how the process develop in a transparent way, I think that's a wonderful thing. Has there been any successes? Like, have you gotten any sense of it gaining traction yet, or is it still starting out?
Yes. So like Gabriel's example is one, there have been So it's spreading mostly so far among the social scientists who are already kind of online a lot. Mm-hmm. So we have a
all the sociologists on Twitter. Get back to work and write my papers instead of recording podcasts with you.
Yeah, that can't hurt. You know, they have the people who have like the easiest uptake are the people who kind of see it all the time. But so we have about almost 1,700 papers in a bunch of disciplines, and you know, they are trickling in at about 3, 4, 5 a day. What's happening is you know, people are starting to build up their success stories, I think. So one of the things that happens is, like Gabriel's example, you have a paper that's under review somewhere, you can share it. When it gets published later, they'll be linked together. You know, that how it's done technically is pretty simple. But if somebody stumbles on it on Social Archive in the future, the Social Archive version will be the free version, even if his subsequently published version is behind a paywall somewhere. So it also becomes a way of sharing freely articles that are subsequently mm-hmm. paywalled. Mm-hmm. And it's so the easiest use case where it's really worked the best for people is when they have an article that's sort of accepted. You know, if you think about the way it used to be a year ago, you'd run into somebody at a conference and say, "Boy, I've got a great paper coming out. You're going to love it." And then like that's the end. But now you can say, "Well, I have a great paper coming out, and here you can read it." You know, of course, you could have put it on your website before or whatever, but now this is sort of institutionalized. You can say it's peer reviewed. It's definitely okay. It's going to be in a fancy journal. It really matters, and you don't have to wait 18 months to read it. You can read it here, and doing it that way without undermining the traditional publishing process that's sort of our easiest sell, and I think that's where it's working best for people.
Is there any type of traction being gained in sort of posting null findings or anything of that sort?
Well, I mean, this is part of a much bigger set of questions, which is why do we have this really archaic and hidebound method of publishing that is publishing articles, only when they're done. And then when they're published, they're finished and it's over. Mm-hmm. And that's related to the problem of what about null findings? What about findings that are not exciting? Mm-hmm. And there's really no, it's easy to do that here. Like I have done a few papers on Social Archive that are just very short empirical reports of something I really didn't have time to write up and go through peer review with, mm-hmm. but I provide the data and code. It's a census analysis or something that's pretty straightforward. I say, look, no one's done the divorce rate yet for 2015 with some basic controls. Here it is. Mm-hmm. And I share the code and data. And, you know, I think if we can start changing the workflow a little so that we're more accustomed to to collaborating earlier, sharing earlier in the research process, we'll start breaking out of that thing where everybody's in their office until an article is done, and then it kind of slides out from under the door in finished form.
Do you find that most of the people who are submitting, do they tend to just be quant people, or are you getting a mix?
Oh no! It's a mix, and across disciplines. I mean, some niches are more early adopters than others, mm-hmm. And not everybody has to share their data. I mean, I know this is a big issue with ethnography and qualitative work in general. Where, do you want me to publish all of my field notes?
That's what I was asking. Yeah.
Which is a great discussion. You know, there's a great debate to be had about that. But it's certainly not, it's not required at all. I mean, it's one of the things that like you ask about the issue of the, you know, research notes and null findings. It's one of the differences between qualitative work and like stuff I do is all secondary data sets. So an ethnographer goes into the field or interviews a bunch of people and all this, you know, 10,000 pages of field notes, a million words, and they always tell us this, you know. And then they produce a book, which is 200 pages, and we trust them that they've, you know, done it right or whatever. But then they just walk away, and it's sort of, you know, there's no other. I don't think in the other parts of the discipline we are used to. It would sort of be like if I did census analysis and I just published the regression table. And that was it, mm-hmm. you know. So, like, where's the descriptive statistics, and where's the data and code for someone else? So, it's a really difficult and complicated question for qualitative researchers. But there is a way that there were in different pages on this issue of sharing and openness, for sure. Mm-hmm. I don't have a resolution to that, but one of the things we're trying to get at is we want to make it useful for everybody, regardless of their style of work and regardless of their overall philosophical orientation towards open scholarship or whatever. So if you just want to put your completed papers up, that's great. If you want to do drafts, you can do drafts. You can do data and code. You can do multiple versions. You can collaborate with strangers. You know, there's all different styles, but we're trying to push everything in the direction of at least getting people to consider opening up their work.
I think it could be really awesome. You know, the discipline is small, but it's also very big. And like the chance to look up work in progress from people, if everybody were to put their research memos up and their partial findings and works in progress, I think it'd be easier for people to find others who share their research interest and take a look at their code, share data. I got a lot of learning. It could be really great.
You know, Jeff Spies, who is the developer of the Open Science Framework, likes to say that if somebody makes a critical comment early in the process, yeah, they're your collaborator for life. And if they make a critical comment after it's published, they're your enemy for life. So it's pretty good to get your ideas up, get your name on them, get a timestamp, and say, look, I had this idea. I'm working on this thing. I have some preliminary results. And let's talk. It's much different from you know, waiting 2 years, yeah, and having it appear as a finished thing.
You know, I think that people face a very strong disincentive in our current environment to come across as wrong. And I'd sure like to see there develop a norm where we look at each other's works and process and take a constructive attitude and correct each other's work. And as opposed to, you know, hiding mistakes that we make, or you know, trying to maintain the pretense that we're never wrong or that we don't make mistakes. And I feel like opening up could do that.
There's I had two experiences so far with American Sociological Review where I sent comments pointing out, I don't get to get into the details. Don't get me started on the details. Where I sent comments to the editors with like absolutely demonstrably proving that things they had published were wrong. And in both cases, you know, they're not the most serious things in the world were wrong, but just things that were definitely wrong. In both cases, the response was, and these were 15 years apart, yes, well, you're right, but you know, we don't need to make a big scandal out of it. We don't need to allocate our precious pages to it. Mm. You know, so this idea, I'm totally agreeing with you, this idea that to be a little bit wrong is sort of a career ending or scandalous, or you're going to make lifelong enemies, instead of, you know, hey, gosh, wait, try this variable, you know, maybe that'll work. And
although what's funny about that is ASR has been publishing more comment and replies. I feel like there were, I'm looking through it right now. Hmm. I feel like there's at least two and I think three this year, which is a lot.
And are they not knockdown, drag out things where people end up enemies for life?
I don't know, but right. And my favorite That's part good. Of a comment and reply is the reply where somebody's always like, well, you know, even though you showed that my data was based just on a coding error, and it turns out it was just a simulation that I forgot I programmed, I'm still right, you know. So, like, the best one of those is Willie Asso saying, like, well, maybe people do have sex 1,000 times a week. You don't know, you know. But you know, even if, let's assume that ASR goes even further and they publish a comment and reply every issue, right? It still wouldn't necessarily be enough.
Yeah, it's not the process.
You know, you still need a process to allow things. And you know, let's take for the sake of argument and say that, you know, you showed pretty definitively that, you know, or at least very plausibly that Goffman's, you know, quantitative component, if you want to call it that, had some problems with it or was implausible or didn't match the census data. You know, but they kind of had the attitude of like, well, you know, if you raise this in review, it would have been a whole nother round of ASR of R&R or even a rejection. Whereas you're raising it ex post. So there's kind of a notion of as long as you're not completely destroying the paper, we're going to let it go. And so this, I'm agreeing with you that this allows kind of an intermediate stage.
Well,
if there's a problem, it may be secondary on a secondary point, but there is a problem and let's flag it.
there's a stronger, larger argument about the publishing process, which is an argument for post-publication review, which is a whole different issue. I mean, what we're doing now is allowing people to kind of open up earlier within the existing process. But this idea that when it's done is kind of poisonous. And the fact that it's so tied to reputations, I think, is a problem. Alice Goffman said in one of her interviews, you know, if I had to do it again, I would have written a methodological appendix explaining that point. But there was no reason why she couldn't have done that then. You know, the book. So, sorry, the book is published, so there's no way in the world anybody could ever possibly learn this information now because the project is done. There's no reason to run research that way. One of the interesting things that it's off Search Archive, but on the Open Science framework, the platform allows is forking a project. So the project, as you build the project, you've got your research materials, transcripts, or interview code, or whatever they are. It saves everything. It saves a complete history of the project as you put things up, and then you can go back to a point in time and create a duplicate of the entire project at that moment and take it in a different direction. So you could say, let's go back to before I introduced that variable and try some other variables and produce, you know, and then you're off in another direction with a different paper and so on. And there is there are other ways to do this, which we really should experiment with.
So something I wanted to contrast Search Archive to favorably is, you know, if you search on Google Scholar or whatever, you end up seeing that a lot of people post their papers on ResearchGate. And I forget, there's another service that's basically the same thing.
Academia.edu.
So, and, you know, a couple of years ago, the University of California adopted an open access policy where all papers we write as University of California professors have to be posted in an open access forum. And it could be the university's own open access forum, or it could be a third party such as Social Archive. And what's interesting is that they explicitly exclude academia.edu and ResearchGate. And, you know, one reason they sometimes give, and I know you sometimes feel like this, is that, well, they're for profit, and so we don't trust them. I myself don't have those kind of priors, right? I don't feel like something being for profit is necessarily disqualifying. There's plenty of for profit things that are great. But in this case, you know, evaluating it on the merits, these things suck. And in particular, they're less platforms for hosting your paper than platforms for constantly finding excuses for spamming you about, you know, so it's like, oh, somebody you cited just posted a new paper. Yeah. Why don't you come read it? And they're doing that look at me thing that, you know, a lot of apps and websites and whatnot do, the whole, like, you know, do you want to turn on notifications for this web page?
Well, there's a marketer who's like, we need to increase user engagement. Like, that's a...
Exactly. Yeah. But whereas, like, you know, Philip, your program, I mean, you don't give a damn about user engagement. You just care about, you know, giving me a place to post my code and my paper and my data.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes, I agree. And I actually don't have, something being for profit gives me one reason to be skeptical, but is not disqualifying. Sure. So I guess I'm maybe close to your position on that. But I think one of the key questions is this reason for being, right? So I think ResearchGate and academia are more like Facebook in that the user is the product and the content is the and what you get for it is how they attract.
Well, not only that, but they have a social spam growth strategy, right? Where their fundamental growth strategy is find out ways to demand that you spam everybody in your address book to get them to also join.
And also tiered membership, or at least they were floating that idea where if you paid to a premium membership, you'd get more of, like, more people would get spammed with your stuff. Right. I think we also want to think about ways that the research community, however that's defined, you know, researchers, universities, libraries, can run these things, and which is sort of with a different with a different outlook. And that's one way that you would sort of probably notice the difference. But the other is, you know, we're on an open source platform. If the Center for Open Science, which is our host, sells out, you could download the whole thing and put it up on your own server if you wanted to. All their code is on GitHub, and the thing is replicable. And that's sort of that's a principled thing, which I'm happy with. I don't know if it's absolutely essential, but you know, it's interesting with the, when you think about these, you know, this that kind of institutional imperative. You mentioned it at California. If we had, you know, we're not that far away from being able to do more expansive participation in these things with our universities, our libraries, and our professional associations buying into these concepts. So, I mean, I think those are great. I actually don't think a lot of University of California faculty, I mean, I think a lot are not actually doing that, what they're supposed to be doing. But those kind of initiatives are good, and we need to have these things in place to take advantage of them. Because at the same time, Elsevier is building infrastructure to play that role also. And maybe it'll be great and we'll all end up using it, or it'll be terrible and we'll all get stuck using it. But I'd like to imagine that we're going to have a fighting chance to put something up that's in the public.
Well, I think what you're saying about that Open Science Framework allows you to mirror the project is really, you know, that doesn't just seem like, oh, these are like open source fanatics who, you know, insist on doing everything through Emacs. I think there actually is a practical upshot to that, which is, you know, it provides resistance against damage and censorship. And we actually have seen that sort of thing happen where there was a series of ADA lawsuits against universities for posting academic podcasts, and in particular, posting podcasts of lectures for courses. And the way the ADA...
Because they weren't captured.
Yes, because they didn't also provide a transcript. And so it's on the logic of if there's one kid in the playground who's diabetic, then none of the kids can have ice cream. So most universities, because putting up a podcast is cheap, you know, the room already has a microphone. All you need to do is, you know, patch a copy of that feed over to a central server and then put an RSS on it. It's the kind of thing that scripts and scales. Whereas transcripts are not scalable. Most universities just took down their academic podcast. So for instance, my lecture course has a podcast, but it's gated to only be accessible to UCLA students. And there's nothing I can do about that.
What's the rationale for gating it to UCLA only?
Because so that they don't get sued by ADA trolls.
Oh, interesting.
And so to hook this to Philip's point, because Berkeley had a copyleft license on all of its academic podcasts, even though they took the podcast down to avoid ADA trolls, there was nothing to stop anybody else from mirroring them. And in fact, an open source project took all of the Berkeley lectures, you know, thousands of hours of high quality academic lecture content, and mirrored them so that you can still have access to them, even though Berkeley itself wasn't hosting them.
Yeah, that's good. You know, I think I would just put in a plug for the accessibility issue. You know, Berkeley could also, there is software that can create transcripts, which are maybe 90%.
Oh, if it's doable in a scalable way, I'm all for it. But if it's realistically a choice, you have to pay $5,000 per course to have it hand transcribed, or, you know, then nobody's going to do that.
Right. No, but your point is well taken, that whatever the institutional contamination or bias or obstacles that are put in place, having your content be open allows, you know, creative solutions to that. Is, I think that's.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be the ADA. It could be that, you know, there's some troll campaign, you know, attacking the university for hosting it or whatever.
Right. Or if you think about the Third World Studies article that got taken down because it was so unpopular, or other things where there's outcry and people try to erase the existence of the offending.
Exactly. Material. It's insurance against the memory hole.
Well, I'm always going to remember that article. So.
All right, should we shift gears, go to the book then?
Sure.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, it's Thanksgiving, right? It's Thanksgiving. I mean, a book about family.
Actually, it's the Monday. day after Thanksgiving by the time anyone hears this. You know, you're breaking the illusion of the magic of podcasts, right?
Well, how about this? How about we pretend that it is the Monday after Thanksgiving and I'm still getting over the trauma? So, and so I think that's a great segue into enduring bonds.
The trauma is happening right now over here. Let's talk about your upcoming book, Philip. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Sure. Yeah. Well, I started writing. I was working on two things at once. So I wrote a textbook called The Family, which came out in 2014, and that took me about 6 years. So somewhere around 2008, I started working on that. And at the same time, I started blogging about family and inequality issues. And the logic of doing it was that the textbook was, you know, taking forever. And it was full of writing a textbook on, I mean, I'm a family sociologist, but 13 chapters, you know, I was only plausibly an expert when I started on maybe three or four of them. So I learned all kinds of new things and I had no feedback or engagement with people for most of that process. So it was kind of lonely and blogging was just kind of catching on. So it was great to be able to do a blog while I did it. Anyway, so short story long, on the family inequality blog over all those years, I wrote about 800 or 900 blog posts. And usually they had a little bit of data. They had a little bit of an argument, either connected to something in the news or something about research, like academic blogs did in the heyday of academic blogs. And when I got to the point a year or two ago, where I had this huge body of kind of half-baked work. Naomi Schneider at University of California suggested I do a book of essays. So what I ended up doing was kind of content coding them into categories. I took the most popular 200, coded them into categories, and then started combining them into longer essays, updating all the data. Cool. It was a great process. And so the result is a book of about 6 or 7 chapters, sort of grouped them, the things, if you read the blog, the things I tend to harp on. You know, things like naming practices, poverty, family structure, marriage promotion, Mark Rignaris. Each of these kind of gets its own chapter, Disney, dimorphism.
Do you recommend? Oh,
yeah, you are not a fan of the dinner plate eyes.
Exactly. Do you? How is that as a process? Would you recommend that to other people to blog a book?
Well, blog to book is a whole genre now, and there are people who are probably much better at it than I was. But yeah, I do. I mean, the great thing about it was all the people that I met and sort of talked about the blog posts with along the way. So people who would, you know, when I write about cohabitation and marriage, you know, like some people there, some. Like Gosta Esping Anderson would like jump on them into my comments and say something. Or if I talk about gender segregation, like Bilby would show up and say things about it. And it was great. You know, so I had, kind of a rolling process and, you know, I had tenure and it was all right that I was publishing less in academic journals and having a more interesting life for a lot of that time. But I liked it a lot. I mean, the key thing about writing is writing. You know, if you want to write a lot, if you want to write well, you have to write a lot. If you want to, test out your voice and figure out what you really have to say. I mean, just doing it is definitely the way. And so blogging and it's kind of like writing on deadline, but all the time. And it's like the drug, you know, once people start liking the blog, after a couple of days, I start to feel like lonely and like, gosh, I want some more likes. So I'm going to write another post and, you know, it works.
So I have a question, I'm just thinking about, the subtitle of your book, which is Inequality, Marriage, Parenting, and Everything Else That Makes Families Great and Terrible. Right. What are some of the things that make families terrible?
Well, all the terrible things that happen in families, like abuse and exploitation.
I'm glad you're not mentioning specific
and anxiety.
Family members, but that's
in the case study chapter.
Susan and Bobby.
No, I mean, yeah. Right. I mean, I hit on the idea of enduring bonds was from the Obergefell decision, but Anthony Kennedy's decision where he talked mm-hmm. about sort of marriage as this, you know, he spoke about it in this very idealistic way, like, you know, as we've extended marriage rights, you know, with loving and interracial marriages and now same-sex marriage, we're sort of extending freedom to people. And Scalia had this very caustic response, which was, you're really describing marriage as the extension of freedom. It's literally like a contract that restricts your behavior. That's a recurring tension in families. Like, we love families. Families are essential for our survival and they make us happy and everybody wants a family. And yet a lot of the really bad things in the world happen, in families, rape and abuse and violence and exploitation and, you know, stuff like that, which is, you know, a lot of institutionally protected or shielded, hidden, and so there's a dark side.
My impression of the United States mm-hmm. is that it's a tough place to raise a family. What are your thoughts on that? Do you think Americans make it easy, or do you think it's a particularly difficult place?
I think we make it difficult. You know, the wealth and everything really helps. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to exaggerate that. But in some ways we make it a lot more difficult than it has to be. So, you know, in some more obvious ways, like, work family policies are just, you know, kind of brutal with family leave and childcare and so on. But the other kind of something I try to bring up when I can is what inequality, economic inequality is doing. One of the things it does as far as parenting is make, the stakes higher, and it's sort of a ratchet where the bigger the difference between success and failure, the more anxiety there is that you're doing it wrong when you're parenting. Mm-hmm. When you add to that the sort of the pressure, anxiety that people feel about defining who they are, who their children are. So I have kind of a whole Giddens riff in there about your self narrative and there's a, I mean, I feel like the inequality increases that stress and anxiety. It's kind of hard to prove that.
Well,
but,
in one of our very first episodes, we talked about Raimi and Raimi's Rugrat Race, which is, you know, seems to be a special case of what you're talking about. I'm not sure if you're familiar with it, but
I'm not.
So basically they argued that one of the things that drives America's current culture of helicopter parenting is competition for elite college admission. And so it creates this culture of you have to be, you know, hyper involved parenting in order to cultivate the perfect kid so that they can compete in this kind of tournament for access to the elite.
Mm-hmm. Well, and even and then thinking about it from the opposite end of the spectrum, you know, the New York Times is referring to it as the new Jane Crow. But, you know, the fact that in many ways poverty is criminalized, right? And so, you know, there are low income families across the country. And I'm thinking specifically about New York. And, you know, like who are under these levels of hyper surveillance where it's like, any little thing they do can get their kids taken away, you know, can get them, you know, under even more heightened levels of surveillance and things that, you know, middle class families, because they don't have that same interaction with the state. You know, I was saying, it's like, you know, your kid fell down the stairs and, you know, your middle class parent who has your kid in private preschool, right? It's like, oh, it was an accident. Everyone in the class is going to write a card to you, right? If you're in publicly funded childcare and your kid falls down the stairs, you know, that just might mean you have to be reported to the Administration for Children's mm-hmm. Services.
So, I totally agree. And I think sort of the surveillance is more coercive the lower down various status hierarchies you get, you know. So, you know, the helicopter parents put themselves under a certain amount of pressure, and there's pressure from their friends and people in their neighborhood and schools and so on. And then you get down to the police. We had a we adopted our kids, and the the first time we had a social worker came to the house and was doing the interview and doing the home study. And she went through the interview. She asked us about our parenting style. And, you know, it's not hard to know what to say to pass this. But the truth is, we were pretty much accepted the minute she walked in the house and saw how it was going, you know, in our race and class, and we're professors and the, you know, academics. And there we are in the private home. But she had to ask a few uncomfortable questions, like,
do you have hot water?
Do you have hot water? She asked at one point, she asked if we had any sort of sex abuse in our past. And she literally said to us, say no.
Really?
So it's like, let's just not go down this road. You know, like everything's going well here. Just so you know, I don't really want to know the answer to this question because things are going fine.
What a crazy question to ask, though, to be required to ask.
Yeah. California, it was California. The other, I actually don't know if it was her agency that was, you know, had done that or if there was some law that made her do that. We also went through a mandatory diversity training as adoptive parents, internationally adopting parents, which was fine. It was one night a week for 6 or 7 weeks with a bunch of other parents who were adopting kids from other countries. And, it was awkward in the case of the family from Bangladesh that was adopting a relative that was also from Bangladesh. But they had to go through all the, you know, how traumatic it's going to be for the child and the language gap and the sort of the privilege stuff.
Have a homophily training class available.
No, they don't. What it's like to adopt a kid that's really a lot like you.
And is in fact your second cousin.
For more, visit us on the web, theannexpodcast.com.